to the Buddha, to the Dharma, to the Sangha.
I'll just carry on from where I left off yesterday. It is the morning of the 2nd of November, Rimmel Master says. I awaken upon the shore. It is very dark. I hear the dawn drum, which is the dawn drum at Shasta that she hears there. And I look up and see beings swooping down to the water's edge to sit in their lotus blossoms. I do not want to leave the shore. I want to stay. I want to stay here so much. Something comes and very gently shoos me off the shore into my blossom, and I sit in it and look around me. I see that several of the blossoms have rings of towers around them, their own mandala around them. Then the water seems to evaporate. I am back on the haiseki, the bowing mat. The towers are around me, and I know they are the monks. I do not want to stay down here. I want to get back up as fast as I can. I want to get back to the surface of the lake. But I must understand why the sea evaporated. I must know that here in Shasta is the Buddha land, as above, so below. If I do not make the Buddha land appear for those around me, I am unfit to be a priest. Each of these exquisite creatures, these monks of Shasta, is as a precious jewel given to my keeping by the Lord of the house to guard and to polish. However much I wish to sit above in the beauty and the stillness, it must be my pleasure and my joy to bring them, should they so wish, to this blissful place that they may meet their true Lord. My duty from here on is the harmonization of heaven and earth. This is the meaning of the first line of the Bodhisattva vow. This is the first of the four Bodhisattva vows in one of the most important traditional forms of the Bodhisattva vows. However innumerable beings are, I vow to save them endlessly. The meditation hall of Shasta is the waveless sea, and I have failed in my duty to the Lord if all here do not realize that this monastery is indeed the Buddha land. I am told that I can go back to the shore at night. I must confess I can hardly wait for the night to come. Perhaps there is still some clinging in me. I must watch this tendency. Well, there isn't a human being alive who doesn't prefer heaven to this samsaric realm we live in. I'll tell you that. And doesn't prefer states of bliss to the ordinary difficulties of daily life. And that ain't clinging, that's just, we're all that way. You know, that's not a, Rim Master used to say, it's not a sin to be tempted. You know, and so the thing is to make positive use of our greed. If we long for the Buddha land, we'll train ourselves so we experience the Buddha land. And, as Rev. Master is pointing out here, we need to realize the Buddha land is wherever we find ourselves. That too is the Buddha land. I have to say that as long as I knew Rev. Master, and I knew her for 20 years, really, a little more than 20 years, when the chips were down, again and again and again, I saw her show exactly the attitude that she's talking about here as wishing to truly cultivate within herself. I saw her show it again and again. She showed it to me, she showed it to all of us. This, to see the Buddha in us and to trust our capacity to realize the eternal ourself and to do what she could to clearly point the way for us. And you can see what I said before, that especially after this kind of smack of the sword of Buddha's wisdom, now she's her mind and heart are being open to the teaching on how to live the rest of her life. and not only live the rest of her life as we normally think about it, how to live endlessly, eternally, following the eternal, wherever the eternal leads. And, of course, how can you follow the eternal, where the eternal leads, if you are not really working at seeing the hand of Buddha, the life of Buddha, in everything around you? You know, the eternal is not separate from this samsaric realm, from this realm of suffering, of impermanence. The eternal is the reality of it. It's just that we can't see it with our external eyes. We have to look with the eyes of the heart to see that which is of the heart. She says, however much I wish to sit in the beauty and the stillness, it is my pleasure and my joy to bring them, should they wish so wish, to this blissful place that they may meet their true Lord. And this should they so wish is very important. It's really important. It's a set off by commas. In some ways it should be, I think, should be italicized. Because you cannot force someone to walk this path. You know, its difficulties, its risks are so great that actually the people who don't wish to do so and either come to it and turn away from it right away or later on turn away from it, they really have the sympathy of anyone who walks it, truly. And at the same time, one can't help being sad for those who don't persist through the difficulties to realize what they could realize if they kept going. It's our choice. As I said yesterday, a master doesn't have some kind of magic whereby they can just like bean you on the head and you're enlightened. It doesn't work that way. Any temporary boost given by another human being can only be that, a temporary boost. Whether it be of encouragement, whether it be a kick in the seat of the pants, whatever it be. In the end, you know, it's each of us individually who's making our choices and living our life. And those choices come down to the choices hour to hour, day to day. Above all, of course, they're the choices that have to do with the precepts and what the precepts truly mean, what the true spirit of the precepts is, not just the letter. Many, many religious people seek a kind of safety in the letter of the rule or the letter of the commandment or the letter of the precept. That is not what this is about. To aim for the true spirit, to realize the true spirit of the precepts, is infinitely more than that and requires tremendous faith. The result of it is that one can meet our true Lord, one's true Lord, one's own true nature. She says, my duty from here on is the harmonization of heaven and earth. These are two of the traditional metaphors that are used. Heaven here refers to the realm of nirvana. Earth to the realm of samsara. Heaven to the realm of the eternal. Earth to the realm of greed, hate, and delusion. Heaven to the help of which I speak with a capital H. Earth to the need. Now, obviously, if you think about it, you know, these are opposites, aren't they? They're opposites. They're useful opposites. They're actually necessary opposites. And still, one must not stay stuck in any opposites. There's truth in these opposites up to a point, and then the truth breaks down if you try to carry it too far. Because as I just said, where do you not find the eternal? Where is there not the Buddha nature? Because all is different, you need to know there is heaven and earth. You need to know there is a perceptual path and there is a non-perceptual path. See, that's from the point of view of the all is different. From the point of view of the all is one, you need to know that the Buddha is the reality of everything. The eternal, the unborn, is the reality of everything. Within the oneness of the eternal, there is neither right nor wrong, up nor down, fat nor thin, male nor female, any of these things. And you cannot cram one side into the other. You can't cram the all is one into the all is different and have the all is one disappear into it. You can't cram the all is different into the all is one and have the all is different disappear into it. I heard Master used to say, when I was a very new monk, I heard her say many times, to look with enlightened eyes, you have to look with both eyes. One eye, the all is one. You see the all is one. The other eye, the all is different. But we're obviously not speaking of the physical eyes here. But you have to see both all is one and all is different. Not just one. To see only the all is different is to be stuck in the all is different. To see only the all is one is to be stuck in the all is one. They are both delusional states. They also, like all delusion, they both have an element of truth. But to see only one side of it, one aspect, to be stuck in one aspect, is to be missing the other and not to comprehend it. Most people that you will meet are stuck more or less in the all is different. A few people you will meet are stuck in the all is one. To be stuck in the all is different does not look saintly. To be stuck in the all is one looks saintly, but it's not. Because that which is truly saintly does not appear as such. Be beyond both the holy and the unholy. Let us rescue ourselves and others. In the teachings on reharmonization, that is, the reharmonization of this body and mind, of my karmic need with the eternal, in the teachings on reharmonization, these terms, heaven and earth, appear quite frequently as a handy handy metaphor, isn't it, really? Heaven, the realm of the eternal. Earth, the realm of suffering, samsara. Heaven, the realm of the heart. Earth, the realm of the body. This, you know, the spiritual heart. Earth, the realm of the body. When you hear the term the harmonization of body and mind, the deepest level of that is the harmonization, the deepest level of the meaning of that is where mind is taken to be Buddha mind and body is taken to be this body of karmic need. The harmonization of our karmic need with the Buddha mind. Bring it into alignment with. It's interesting that Rinpoche Master puts this first Bodhisattva vow in this way. However innumerable beings are, I vow to save them endlessly. Some versions of this say, however innumerable beings may be, I vow to save them all. I actually like the endlessly better here. Because it leaves out how many beings are saved or not having anything to do with anything I try to do, it leaves that kind of to the eternal. And what it's really saying is that I will go on doing this training endlessly through life, through death. I will follow the eternal wherever the eternal leads, endlessly, with no limit set on it by me. Not, I will follow the eternal until I can get out of this misery I'm in, and then I'm home free. But I will follow the eternal whether it be through heaven or through hell, whether it be through misery or through joy. I will follow the eternal because the following of the eternal is the only thing in life that is an end entirely of itself. Another thing, another way you could put that is that love, with a capital L, love of the eternal is the only thing in life that is an end entirely of itself. In itself. The next plate is called the Lord's Will. The Master goes on to say, "It is the morning of the 3rd of November. I awaken early and want to get back quickly to a meditation place on the shores of the lake rather than in the sea. But I find I am to assist the Lord of the house. I know that I cannot go deeply into meditation until a specific disciple is in the room. For some reason, the Lord needs him here." That sounds like a peculiar way of putting it. Why would the Lord need anything? Well, your master, this is a way of describing this. Kind of, there is an intuitive sense in her coming from the eternal that so-and-so, for some reason, needs to be here. So instead of sitting there and kind of trying to analyze it and figure out why before she acts, she simply gets the person there, which is the right approach. She says, "The ceiling begins to go yellow, as is the usual when I enter these meditations. And I seem to be looking out of the place in the center of my forehead." Remember where she got smacked? Against, called, sometimes called the third eye or the wisdom eye. But I like better the term the heavenly heart. But there are times when one does, as it were, look out of that place. And as I understand it, that is the place from which visions are seen. "I see myself on the left hand of a being whom I know to be Shakyamuni Buddha, dressed in white. I am holding a canopy over a small and beautiful being seated in a golden lotus that is being held by two other beings like myself. I can feel the lotus crown upon my head, and I know that there is a halo behind it. Shakyamuni Buddha bends forward and takes the little being into his arms. For a long time he embraces it, then he straightens up, and the golden lotus goes of itself back to the sea. The little being is placed in his newly opened lotus blossom. We turn and follow Shakyamuni Buddha into one of the huge shadowy temples that are here, but we only go just within the door whilst he goes inside. I want to go inside too, but I know that I should not. The other beings who are with me troop back to the shore and enter their lotus blossoms. I linger on the shore. I do not want to go. I turn and look back, and Shakyamuni Buddha is outside the temple. He waves to me. I go to my lotus blossom, and as I look back at the shore, I see him rise up from where he is standing and become absorbed into the great golden cosmic Buddha that I now see in the sky. He is taken into the cosmic Buddha and yet is separate from him. He is not the cosmic Buddha, but there is nothing in him that is not of the cosmic Buddha. The two are inseparable and different." This is exactly that oneness and difference I was just speaking of, being shown her in a really beautiful way. "I ask what I should do for this day. Should I wish to stay in this heavenly place, or is there something else that the Eternal Lord wishes? I am told that for this day I should sit within my lotus blossom and meditate until I am needed to do something else. This is what I am doing. The white figure descends from the sky and enters the mark on my forehead. I feel him within my hara. The monk who is with me saw part of this today." Remember, the white figure is the Shakyamuni Buddha. this is a good time to speak of what is called the child of the Lord. This is another term that is frequently found in the teachings on this and on the reharmonization. And sometimes it's referred to as a child. Sometimes, interestingly enough, it's referred to as a little girl. We need to refer back here to what we've seen in discussing the nature of our karmically inherited spiritual need and the nature of the transformation that takes place at the time of deep conversion. If you remember when Rim Master, you can take the Rim Master's experience of the tiger as kind of archetypal in this regard. Remember how the tiger kind of disappeared into a dot, and then from there a little tear, kind of golden tear-shaped object appeared in the hara, and then like a little bud, and then after that a little Buddha appeared in the hara. Well, if we think of that as basically what that's teaching, it's teaching about the nature of conversion. And if you think about what some of the practical ramifications of that teaching are, practical implications, remember, you know, Buddhism is very practical, and you never actually get far from the practical. So, you know, what can it possibly mean that a spiritual need that manifested clearly in the life and death and the spiritual koan or problem of an animal like a tiger, what could that mean that thousands of years later someone's training and meditating and this happens within them and this kind of tiger disappears into this dot and then a little later a little Buddha manifests in the hara? It's talking about what happens as a result of the spiritual need getting the help of the eternal. And it is at one and the same time, and this is that one of the things you just cannot comprehend, it is at one and the same time a kind of dissolving into immaculacy of nothingness of that need. It's like what was there before disappears into nothingness. It's like that little tiger disappearing into a dot, you know. But the process doesn't stop there. This thing, the process doesn't stop there. All that despair, that confusion, that longing the Rim Master had inherited down the ages, and it had, if not its ultimate origin, certainly a major source of origin in that particular past life. And I'm going to say something that's going to sound peculiar, but there is a merit in all of that. This would be like, when I say, that's kind of like a Christian starting to talk about the merit or the virtue of sin, almost, you know. But of course, this is not Christianity, and Buddhism is a non-dualistic religion, which means that there is not some ultimate evil opposed to some ultimate good, which are at war with one another, where one or the other has to be the victor. There is this raw material of enlightenment, which we call greed, hate, and delusion. There is the raw material of enlightenment, and then there is the process through which this raw material is refined and transformed, and enlightenment made out of it. The child of the Lord, the little Buddha that manifests, is the enlightening of the need. It is greed, hate, and delusion as they truly are, rather than as what we get stuck with. What greed, hate, and delusion truly are is compassion, love, and wisdom. They've just been swamped by saddened love, by looking outwards, by ignorance, and have got off track, as it were. But even in being off track, they're never outside the eternal. And therefore, there is always a way back. And the process of birth and death, the process of rebirth, gives them a vehicle back, a way back. So what does the baby Buddha, what does the little child, the little being here mean in this vision? That Shakyamuni Buddha and the others are taking such great care of and showing such great love for. That is someone's spiritual need that is getting the message. Maybe, I don't know who it was that River Master called into her room, but it may be that very person that River Master called into her room at this time. May have been something in them that was in the process of making this transformation, and River Master was actually sitting there seeing it in vision. It would not surprise me in the least. But it's another, this is, put it quite simply, someone's getting it. Someone's getting it. Someone's getting what they came to this for. Someone's cottoning on. Someone's heart is open to the eternal. Yeah, there's a baby Buddha waiting to be born out of all of the need that we have. And there's no one and nothing beyond help. Not my help. What can I do? I'm just a suffering person like everyone else. Not River Master's help. The Eternal's help. And sometimes the Eternal can use a River Master or even a Koshin. God help us all, even a Koshin or a or an Olaf, or a Tejo, or a Jerry, or a, you know, anyone. Sometimes the Eternal can use another human being, a human being to help, and it is the work of the Eternal. When I experienced my Kensho in 1977, I don't know if River Master talked about this with us or not at that point, but I actually experienced this process she's talking about happened very fast. And the spiritual need shot up the back, went out the top of the head, came back in, I believe in at the third eye, just as what he's been described here, and ended up back in the hara, only now it was transformed in the hara. It all happened in a very short time. I don't know how long it took, but just might have been as short as a few seconds. But I was completely very, very aware of it. In this case, the karmic need was something from my own childhood that was, I was completely unaware of what defect it had on me, but I found out there. But, you know, karmic need is karmic need, and the help of the Eternal is the help of the Eternal. And what is a little child or a little baby? A little boy, a little girl, a little baby, anything. It's a very vulnerable little being that needs a great deal of love and protection and needs to be guarded while it matures. And it is so very important that we guard that which is within our own heart, that we guard this process of conversion. that we protect it from the idle and curious. You know, you remember the Dogen says in instructions to the chief cook, one of his instructions to the cook is to protect the morning gruel, I believe it is, from the idle and the curious, or protect the soup from the idle and the curious. And that's what you have to do with that which is within your own heart. The deep contemplative work is done away from the curious and doubting and often sarcastic attitudes of the world. It needs to be protected. It's a very pure, innocent baby is protected by a responsible and loving parent. It must be allowed to mature at its own rate, which is not set by me. You can't just sit there and watch the clock on this. It takes as long as it takes. Reb Master used to say, you know, we retreat from the world in order to advance. And the truly contemplative life has its own demands that have to be respected, its own requirements that have to be respected. People who attempt what we are doing and do not respect the limits within which it can be done successfully, do not succeed in the doing of it. This is why it's a normal thing for a person who's living in the world, whether that person be a lay person or a priest who's living in the world, in closer association with the world than a priest living in a more contemplative monastery. It's a normal thing for those people at that time, at the time of the really deep conversion process needing to happen, to retreat into a monastery somewhere where they can be, where the monks can form a mandal around them and protect them. From the world. And provide the best possible context for the inner work to happen, again at its own pace. And it cannot be rushed. You know, at the deeper levels, you know, a person can't just set, you know, you're going to set 1 week aside a year to go into the monastery. That won't work. It'll take as long as it takes. It may be months, it may be a year or more in some cases. Genuine contemplatives know that the process I'm talking about and the kind of priority I'm speaking of is not the exception for a true contemplative, it's the norm. And it's a very great danger living in the midst of a completely non-Buddhist culture with non-Buddhist values. It's a very great danger for us that we will not completely make the transition from the point of view of Western religion that most have been raised, of us have been raised with, and the point of view of Western secular attitudes that our society is swamped with. That we will not, it is a danger that we will not make the transition from that to a truly contemplative point of view and not understand and appreciate the kinds of limits that the contemplative life requires. I can only speak of this temple and of my own priorities as abbot of this temple in this regard. What anyone else does is their business, and I'm not concerned about it. But for this temple, this process and the ability of people to undergo this spiritual process has always been very consciously the priority here. And whenever it happens with someone at a deep level, basically everything else in the temple has to take second place to that happening and has to support it. My point of view is that we're all going to get our chance, and usually it's only one or two people at a time, if that, who are able to do the deep retreats, drawn into the deep retreats. And it is the priority here. It has to be. At least for me, it has to be. We have to guard well the child of the Lord. Not entrust that child to the worldly and to those who doubt. Buddha, Siddhartha, Siddhasangha.